one of my very favorite Bruce Springsteen songs. It's called Human Touch. It really just builds. It's a lot of feeling in this thing, and it's sort of consistent with what we're doing tonight with my guests Tom Carey and Don Schmidt. They put a human touch, a human face to the Roswell story, telling us about the eyewitnesses, their family members, and what happened to them, the kinds of intimidation tactics used by the military to keep the story silent, to discredit and intimidate witnesses, threatening to kill them, threatening to kill their family members, tapping their phones, following them around. It's troubling. These are troubling allegations to hear that the military would treat American civilians in this manner. I guess the question is, did they carry out the threats with anyone? And we're going to get into that in a moment and also discuss sort of the larger implications, because the world changed, our country changed in 1947, and the roots of it are right there in Roswell. Things that are still unfolding even today, the rise of the national security state. We'll get into that and open up the phone lines with your questions and comments right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Don Schmidt, tell me, with all these threats that were made, are there any suspicious deaths, you think, any cases where it looks like maybe they carried out the threats, that someone went too far and they had an accident as a result?
We've always focused, for example, on the Brazzo family, the original, you know, story, and how it not only impacted Mac Brazzo himself, who would actually die about 20 years younger than his father had, and there's some suspicion regarding that, specifically with the owners of the ranch at that time, the J.B. Foster ranch from Western Texas, and interviewing some of the surviving Foster family members. They believe that Mac, for example, committed suicide. We don't find any evidence of that, but supposedly even when they received the phone call, and the one daughter was in the room receiving the call, and she overheard her father make the comment, well, Mac finally went and did it. He went and killed himself. And then there was a grandson of Mac Brazzo who in 1964, just a year later, was out hunting with two companions. And he and a companion were shot to death. And according to the state police report from Grants, New Mexico, they wrapped up the case by concluding that both hunters were accidentally shot to death by two separate shots.
That's a heck of an accident.
That is a heck of an accident, correct. And then you had the disappearance of Mac's son, Vernon, and there's a whole chapter regarding that, what actually happened with him and how he showed up someplace else under another name, and then would live for another few years unbeknownst to the family. And the point is that the family never had any additional contact with him, that he just disappeared from the face of the earth, and as though he was placed in some type of protection program, or for whatever reason, after he returned from the Navy, he just disappeared.
Well, it's troubling that the military would make these kind of threats to citizens, to American citizens who had done nothing wrong. You know, even if they don't carry out the threats, it's really disturbing. And then, you know, I mentioned before the break about the growth of the national security state. I mean, this is sort of where it started, 1947.
Precisely.
And we see what's happened today, you know, Snowden and the revelations, everything, every communication we have, every email, every phone call, it's going into a computer somewhere.
Well, and as you mentioned, Edward Snowden, and after that whole situation, we've often pointed out that whether one even sees Snowden as a hero, as a traitor, who would have ever foreseen a day that just for being a whistleblower, that you would paint a target on your back and would have to flee this country, of all things. I mean, we're talking, you know, Soviet Union, Russia, where they would, you know, ask for asylum elsewhere. And who would have, again, thought that it would be reversed? It would be the other way around. We have a number of other incidents on our, you know, in our back burner, because we don't see the pressure as we do with Racing the Undertaker with the witnesses, but the late Congressman Stephen Schiff and one of the doctors, one of his oncologists, had even suggested that we'd like to talk. We need to talk to you to discuss what the late congressman had said before he died. And Schiff was famous for the fact that he was pushing for congressional hearings on Roswell. He was pushing the then Secretary of Defense, Les Aspin, for disclosure on the Roswell incident. And he would develop a very rapid skin cancer, and within 6 months, he died at the age of 51. And so that's something we also would like to look into, aside from the Braswell family, as to
there was one other case, George, that we mentioned in the book. And it's the first time we mentioned this, but Inez Wilcox, the wife of the sheriff of Chavez County, Wilcox,
yes.
To her dying day, she believed that the government had outed her husband. She used the term snuffed out his life. We know that they roughed him up not once but twice. Now here's the guy who helped them issue the death threats to local civilians to shut them up, and they come around to the sheriff's office and they think, oh geez, I wonder what the military wants with us. Well, they wanted to issue the death threat to George Wilcox and his family as well, and they roughed them up at the sheriff's office once. They called him out to the base again a few days after that, and when he got back, his wife Inez said it looked like they had roughed him up again. And at that point, he never wanted to run for sheriff again. He basically, according to the family, went crazy. And she felt that in addition to roughing him up out at the base, they had given him something, whether it was a shot or something that resulted in an early onset of Alzheimer's. At least that's what she believed, and she used the term snuffed out his life.
Do you suppose there are documents somewhere still exist? You know, you mentioned about Congressman Schiff wanting to have hearings. A couple of weeks ago, I had a chance to produce a story based on an interview with John Podesta, and that, yes. You know, Podesta saying, hey, if Hillary gets in, we want to open up the files, which is sort of what Bill Clinton had said and failed to do. And Podesta has been beating this drum for a long time. And it's amazing that he would say that during the heat of a political campaign, whether they do it or not. It's amazing that he would be so open about it. I just wonder if you guys think that there are any files still be found.
We think that there are files, of course. I mean, how could you destroy something like that? But as Congressman Schiff found out with the Government Accounting Office, those files, at least they were told that they had been destroyed without authority. Now, in the military, you can't go to the bathroom without authority. You know what I mean? So they couldn't destroy files without authority. So I think we believe, at least I do, that the files are somewhere. Where they are, we don't know. But it's something to consider that, and you're right about Podesta, with the coming out, you know, during the heat of a campaign, to say that his candidate wants to open up the UFO files, because so far we've had a number of presidents, starting with LBJ when he was running for vice president in 1960. I can recall him saying, well, if John Kennedy and I get elected, we're going to open up the UFO files. Well, of course they won, but you never heard about the UFO files after that. Jimmy Carter, same thing. He was going to release unsettling disclosures in 1976. That never happened. Ronald Reagan, I guess, came the closest when he gave that speech at the UN where he said, now imagine if the Earth were attacked by an outside force, and it would cause the nations of the world to unite to repel it. Well, Reagan himself had a couple of UFO experiences, but we didn't see any files. And Bill Clinton himself said that he dispatched Webster Hubble to find out two things when he took office in 93, find out who killed JFK and to find out if UFOs are real. And, of course, I guess Webster Hubble ran into some legal problems of his own, and we never did have any follow through on that. But I am, I am surprised that Hillary herself has mentioned, in addition to Podesta, she herself has mentioned that she thinks we may have already been visited. Now, to me, that's a startling statement for a presidential candidate to make. Because
yeah, I had the same reaction. The story we did was picked up by media all over the world. It got a lot of attention. I can't imagine that it helps them in the campaign. I guess maybe they've figured out that it does in some regard. We're going to take a couple of calls. Let's start with East of the Rockies, John in St. Louis. Hi, John. You're on with Don and Tom.
Yes, good morning. I really love the show. I think something I like, I got a comment and a question at the end.
Okay.
You know, I'm from the show me state. I'm a skeptic. I look at both sides of this issue. There must be something going on. I think actually UFOs could be demonic and things like that. But as far as Roswell goes, you know, the thing about the whole UFO thing is there's something probably going on, but what raises a red flag for me is that complete towns, including Roswell and people, have made entire careers from this. So anytime someone's making money from something, that means I respect your, you know, the research that they do and everything, but there is hoaxes and there is things, there is a money motive for this. So speaking with to that point, it seems like why wouldn't they, they really believe this is, there's evidence people had little pieces of metal and then they don't know where it is and all this, they can't find it and all this all these years later. You would think someone, there would be some out there. And if there is, why don't they have a monetary cash reward where someone could do it like anonymously through electronic device or something, but they could come forward with a piece. There was nothing that would motivate people more than a cash reward to bring some little piece of this metal forward.
Well, let's hear the reaction from our guests.
Okay.
Don, you want to start?
Well, we've had, for example, 4 archaeological digs at the debris/crash site starting in 1989. And we don't have tours going out to the site. We don't have anything more than a stone monument that's about a mile away overlooking this arroyo. We consider it still an active archaeological site, so we don't want outside people traipsing around, out sightseeing, taking pictures, that type of thing. So we'd have a golden opportunity there, and we have never taken advantage of this location. It's still very private, still very secret. It's no different than the witnesses. We don't disclose their names without their permission. They're not writing any books. They're not part of any, as far as a prophet of any sort. Walter Haught, who, you know, even as one of the founders of the museum in Roswell, you know, lived as far as very modestly, didn't write a book, didn't do much television unless we asked him to appear with us, for example, on Larry King and a few documentaries. So these people aren't publicity seekers. They're not looking for the quick buck, so to speak. Phil Jones at CBS, when we did CBS 48 Hours, he suggested that, well, isn't it possible that a number of these military types sat around a few drinks one night back in 1947 and concocted this whole thing with the plan of eventually making a ton of money? And I suggested, well, isn't it interesting that they all waited till they were in their 80s, you know, at the brink of, you know, of the twilight of their years, and they finally decided, now is the time. We're going to finally, you know, rake it in. We're going to finally make some money off of this. And he agreed, yeah, it does sound pretty silly, doesn't it?
Well, it's like, as you mentioned, you've got 600 interviews you've done so far. It's a whole lot of people to be in on what it would seem to be a money-making scheme or a hoax. And Tom, it affected the whole town, didn't it, in a way? I mean, it was like they all had a dirty secret. And, you know, today they've got the UFO festival in the museum, but for a long time it hung like a dark cloud over Roswell.
Well, I think Don will agree with me on this, that the town itself doesn't like this. I mean, if you go to Roswell, you know, you'll see the UFO cafe and the UFO cleaners or everything. You know, there's a lot of businesses that has the UFO crash theme to it. But the town elders and a lot of the citizenry, they do not like this association with this UFO crash. But nevertheless, the reason it's the town is name is known around the world is because of it. And the tourist industry has really blossomed in Roswell. People come from all over the world to see. It's like going to Mecca, I guess. But the townsfolk themselves are not all that pleased about it.
Let's try to get one more call in before the next break. West of the Rockies, we have somebody calling from New Mexico, Leo in Albuquerque. Hi, Leo.
Good evening, George. Gentlemen, very, very interesting show. I had two quick questions. The first being what the author's opinion was of Corso's book on the day after Roswell. I read that a few years ago, and I found it very fascinating. And the second was I was wondering whether the description of, he describes the incident in his book, as I recall, the communication between an officer or somebody that he was with telepathically, more or less, through a window situation.
All right, we got about 2 minutes before the break, so I'm going to let them answer that. Thanks for the call.
You bet.
We had the occasion of interviewing Corso on two occasions. And what bothers me personally about Corso is the fact that his account of Roswell, as it turns out, is based, and we have a whole chapter on the late Frank Kaufman, who worked for personnel at the base and was at one time our star witness, one of our star witnesses. And after we were able to demonstrate that he had cut and paste up, and he had forged documents, which he claimed were original officer documents, and describing his involvement with the incident. And so after he was discredited, the sad thing was that Corso's entire account of Roswell is almost verbatim this same discredited witness. And then when we learned that Corso had been to Roswell on two prior occasions, and both times he met with this same individual, as though he was interviewing him and acquiring that description of the incident. And so we don't deny that Corso was involved in some capacity as far as the reverse engineering and the assimilation of the technology into the private sector, that type of thing. But we already described that back in the early 90s, that the government, the military doesn't manufacture anything, that everything is assimilated out into the private sector. So there was nothing new about that as well.
I'll give you my take on Corso real quickly, because I got a chance to meet with him and interview him 2 years before the book came out, before anybody in the UFO field knew his name. And my impression was he didn't know all that much about Roswell. He had his story about handling materials in the office in Washington. But I wasn't impressed by his knowledge of Roswell. So I think he probably relied on people he thought were authorities to fill in some blanks there, and took it from there.
And we would agree wholeheartedly. And then, as we just described, that unfortunately he relied on someone who was not reliable, and took that story into claiming it as his own, and it certainly wasn't.
Well, you have had some, you know, as you mentioned, Kaufman as one example. There have been some bumps, some ups and downs in the course of investigating Roswell for you and other researchers. One incident recently that I want to ask you guys about at some point, unless the callers get to it first, is about the Roswell slides, this incident, because you haven't been on the show since 2014. So it's I want to give you a chance to, and we're not going to dwell on it, but I want to give you a chance to give us your take on that. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back and get to as many callers, comments, and questions as we can in our final segment, talking with Tom Carey and Don Schmidt about the children of Roswell. It's a Paul McCartney ballad called Kicked Around No More. That's from Off the Ground, the expanded album, disc two of the album that was released a couple months after disc one. And we learned a couple of days ago, Paul McCartney kicking off a new North American tour, and he's starting it in, of all places, Fresno. I think I might have to go check that out. We have one segment remaining with Tom Carey and Don Schmidt about their new book, The Children of Roswell. I'll get to as many of your calls as we can coming up here on Coast to Coast AM. Don, I want to hit you with this question about the Roswell slides incident. I don't want to dwell on it again. Here's how my take on it was. You guys and other researchers, you swing for the fences. Sometimes you hit it, and sometimes you don't.
Absolutely. In fact, Roswell is not monolithic. There was many separate issues. We're talking about not only all the witnesses, and there we're talking about the three camps, the civilian, the press, the military, but we're also talking about physical evidence. We're talking about wreckage. We're talking about the possibility of human or bodily remains. And then we're talking about photographs. We're talking about film. So we're going in so many different directions, and as you say, you shoot for the fence. You always have to assume every lead is the lead, is that one breaking point that's finally going to disclose, the entire story as we know it. And as a result, we're constantly being approached by possible bearers of good faith as far as that we have to trust them as far as we can demonstrate that the goods they may be selling may be the real thing, the genuine article once and for all. And the entire situation with the slides, well, I put out a public apology because it was something that we listened to the scientists. We relied on scientists to tell us that it was genuine, it was real. And being a lay person, I had to accept that. I had to at least place my trust in the fact that they knew what they were talking about. And how they could have all been as wrong as they were, that is at least where I had a rude awakening that even the scientists can be tricked, can be as far as made to believe that something is not what it appears to be.
Okay. That's
can
good.
Can I add a couple cents here?
Sure.
Yeah. We did due diligence on those slides for 3 years, George. And the entire way we were called names and every other thing in the book because we weren't coming out with what we had. We wanted to do due diligence. And we went through a number of steps, and part of the problem was that the owner of the slides lived on the West Coast. His representative lived in Indiana. Don lives in Wisconsin. I live on the East Coast in Pennsylvania. And Jaime Musan, who was the putting on the rollout of this, is in Mexico City, so it's geography was made it hard for us to get together. But we went through a number of steps to authenticate these slides, and every step pointed to yes. If one of the steps that we were taking had pointed otherwise, we would have walked. But every step of the way pointed to yes, these are genuine. And at the end of the day, after the presentation was finished, one of the steps fell apart, which we had another investigator check the, he's the best internet investigator that we know of. He went through hundreds and hundreds of images of mummies, which we had ruled out, and he said there's no match. Well, it turned out there was a match, and we didn't learn of it until after the event took place last May 5th. So I'm still in a little bit of disbelief as to what happened, but everything pointed to yes. So
okay.
That's what happened up until the rollout. And one of the big things was this placard. There was a placard, a little sign on it that nobody could decipher. I know I spent 3 years on it, but we sent it out to a number of organizations that specialized in optometry and things like that, and they couldn't, and no one could decipher this slide. Well, a couple of days after the event, here comes someone who said that they deciphered it, and sure enough, they did. And by that time, my head is spinning. How did this happen when no one else could do that? And so it was one of those improbables that we followed everything that we could think of to authenticate them, and at some point,
you follow it where you lead. That's how it works. Sometimes it's a dead end, and sometimes it's promising. Let's go back to the phones. Line one, Joe from the Bronx. Hi, Joe. Good morning. Hello.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Don, now there are two things I wanted to ask you. Do you know of any knowledge that this live alien, the one that was recovered from the Roswell wreckage, was able to dispense to either the military or to anyone concerning where they were from or what their mission was? And also, with such an indestructible metal, the memory metal, why is there such a wide debris field?
Yes, yes. Well, I'll answer the second question first. And we're asked that question quite oftenly. And we never say the material, and just as the witnesses have never described it as being indestructible, totally indestructible. We use the term that it was near indestructible, that they couldn't fire bullets through it, that a 16-pound sledgehammer couldn't even scratch the material, that type of thing. And as we would point out, everything that's manufactured has to be malleable at a certain level. It has to have a fracture point, a stress point. And in the case of this wreckage, this material, its fracture point just happened to be much higher than ours. And you certainly have seen the progression of materials that we have developed through the decades and how our material, too, continues to increase in its fracture point. This just happened to be much higher. And whatever caused it to break up, whether it was an internal explosion or a strike from lightning, as Tom had mentioned at the beginning of the show, it caused it to break up. It just reached that fracture point. Okay, as far as whatever information given from the survivor was acquired, conveyed during the time that they had, we leave that again as far as to other experts as to where they come from. We often say we leave that to the astronomers as far as any communication. I still maintain that's a cover-up of ignorance. We still don't have any answers, and as a result, I don't believe that we ever acquired any information that we've been able to utilize from a survivor.
Joe, thanks for the call. We're going to Mark in Maryland. Good morning, Mark.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for having me. I want to say, first of all, it's a high honor to speak with all of you, and I appreciate that. Mr. Schmidt, I've read all of your books, and they line my walls.
Thank you so much.
And, I'm happy to note that the Operation Roswell is still an ongoing venture. You know, first of all, I'd just like to say very quickly, you know, I mean, the first headline out of the newspaper was RAAF captures flying disc. You know, so for me, that sums it up. I mean, you know, they said they captured flying disc, and as far as I'm concerned, in my own mind, that's what it was, flying disc. My question is, Mr. Walter Hott, isn't it true that on his bed, that there's a book called Witness to Roswell that I read, and I think that, like, in the last chapter, when he was, like, near death, he was lying in the hospital, he spoke, he signed an affidavit, and he gave a deposition. And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on that, if you could, you know, give what your thoughts on the veracity of his part, his role in the entire event was.
Yes, Walter, of course, the book Witness to Roswell is written by us, if you didn't know that. and Walter, we knew Walter for years, and he is one of the finest gentlemen you'd ever want to know or meet. If you had an organization, you would want Walter to be its president. And such an honorable man he was. But as Don mentioned earlier, we had suspected over the years, being the right-hand man of Colonel Blanchard, the base commander at the time, he had to know more about the Roswell incident than he was letting on. I mean, he was right in the eye of the storm. And so we approached Walter because he was gradually giving out a little more, like saying, this is what happened, and he would say something, but just don't ask me how I know. Well, we, over the years, we also talked to witnesses who placed Walter at various places with a piece of wreckage. So we put together what we thought Walter knew. It was a series of bullet points. that what we thought he had to know about and maybe participated in, and presented it to him, I think it was about 2002 or 2003. Walter, take a look at this. Would you consider signing a sealed statement? Take a look at this with your family and your lawyer. Go over it, and what is not true, excise, and if you want to add things to it, add to it. And so ultimately, he did sign it in the presence of his lawyer and another witness and his family. And but as far as his integrity, I mean, he's right up there with Jesse Marcel Jr. As someone who is just impeccable, you know. It's just one of those people that is an honorable man, and I just can't imagine him telling an untruth.
Thank you, Mark. East of the Rockies, Aaron in Wisconsin. Hi, Aaron.
Good morning, gentlemen. Don, I got to meet you in 2011 in the Burlington Vortex Conference, so hello again.
Well, hello, and thanks for staying up so late. So I appreciate it.
I'm just north of you in Plymouth right now. So
wonderful.
I have a question about, you know, we've all heard about how everyone had to be quiet about what they saw in Roswell. And in the movie Roswell, Mac Brazel's character, played by Dwight Yoakam, was seen driving out of town in a brand new pickup truck.
Right, right.
Do you think Mac was paid off, the real-life Mac was paid off to be quiet?
Well, keep in mind there was a $3,000 reward at that time, which was a year's income by today's standards. And there was two newspapers and a private individual offering $1,000 each. And the fact that they had abducted Brazel, they kept him for days, and what it would have taken for him to finally capitulate, to finally, you know, retract the story. And we've had numerous eyewitnesses, including Loretta Proctor, the late Bob Wolf, who saw him, you know, picking up feed at a granary some weeks later. He was driving a new pickup truck. And Brazel was often described as someone who barely had two nickels to his name. And yet he had money for a pickup truck. He bought as far as a meat locker, as far as up in Colorado, and all of a sudden had money that nobody, you know, could understand that he came into possession of at that time. So just putting two and two together, did he finally say, hey, you know, I'll take that $3,000?
Did he ever tell his family about that, Don? Did he ever tell anyone anything?
Well, what's amazing is that his family just always, you know, and Dad would never have done that, as Bill would say. Dad, you know, if he ever got in trouble with the government, we would have called out the Klan, as he put it, you know, that the family would have united to defend their father. But the fact that others have described that, yes, indeed, Brazel showed up with a new pickup truck, you know, within days after the incident.
Aaron, thanks for the call. Tom, let me ask you this question. You know, we assume that the public is ready for the truth, that the files could be opened. You guys are certainly working in that direction to tell the full story about Roswell. Is it possible that maybe there's a reason to keep the ultimate story quiet? Have you considered it? That there's something that we don't know yet?
Oh, you mean why the cover-up still?
Yeah, I mean, I can see there's a reason in 47, because we're just out of the war. Why now?
We talk about that often, George. And the reasoning that I think is that it's multifaceted. One is that oftentimes you have something that you start and it gets a life of its own, like a cover-up. You covered it up back in 47, and it's always been cover up, so let's just keep it that way. Let's not make any ripples, you know.
Inertia.
There's no public mandate to open the files. You know, we talk about it, and UFO, you know, para, you know, UFO people talk about it, but there's no public urgency mandate to do this. So, without any pressure, the government is not going to admit a lie that they've been perpetrating on the citizenry for the last 70 years, because somebody will have to pay a political price. Even though they might disclose somebody's going to pay a political price, and no one wants to be that person or persons. That's my take on it.
Let's try to get one more call in west of the Rockies. Wayne in Washington. Wayne, good morning. Better make it a quick one here.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. George, have you ever interviewed yourself, David Adair, or do you gentlemen know about the David Adair story?
Yes, I do.
Okay. He's one person that was alive in 1971 and taken into Area 51 and shown the sentient engine from a UFO. He would be a very interesting person to interview about that, and he's still alive and well as far as I know. So if you guys can put it together and get him that information to talk to him or visit him, I think you'd find some amazing things.
Do you have a question for these guys?
Well, you know, the one thing that amazes me about the David Adair story is he was able to develop a miniature fusion engine in 1971 for his model rocket. Well, I think that's where the Air Force, you know, finally started developing fusion vehicles to go into outer space with a miniature shuttle, when they came up with the miniature shuttle program and the secret space program.
Well, George, it sounds like someone you should talk to.
Yeah. Thank you, Wayne, for the comments.
I wanted to add one quick thing. As far as to the another reason for the cover-up, and it would certainly tie in with our book, and that is the government culpability, the fact that if indeed they were threatening, and possibly worse, all of these witnesses to what they would explain away as just being a very conventional weather balloon device, that they would have hell to pay. Just imagine the class action suit after all these years, that if the families were to unite and actually take a stand against the government and say that we were treated as far as in such a manner over something so obscure, and yet we have never been able to speak out, we've never been able to, you know, even speak out in behalf of our loved ones, our families, our fathers, our husbands, that type of thing. And so what government official is going to even step forward and acknowledge, yes, we did all that, but we had to. It was a matter of national security. And then the whole can of worms would open up to the degree that it would then, you know, be disclosure overnight, so to speak.
Well, I wondered whether there might be a legitimate reason that the technology itself, maybe they're working on something to get ready for the next time the aliens come back, or at a minimum keeping it away from the hands or a step ahead of the Russians, the Chinese, things of that sort. But
well,
I'll tell you what, we'll save that.
They can't find the on button. They still don't know how that could work.
Well, we'll save that for the next time you guys come back, because as you've indicated, the work goes on. The mystery is not solved, and you still have a lot of leads to follow.
Yes, we do. Yes, we
do. All right, thank you, guys. I appreciate it. The book is called The Children of Roswell, Tom Carey and Don Schmidt. Great, great book. Good guests. Thanks very much. Thanks also to Brad Steiger, whose book, The Real Visitors, Voices from Beyond, was in our first hour. And thanks to my colleagues, Jeff DeRay, Aaron Bobo Johnson, Dan Galani, our webmaster, Greg Bishop, and our producer, Chris Boros. Next Sunday, my guest, rock and roll star turned UFO entrepreneur and investigator, Tom DeLonge. See you then. Good night.